Shalom, Chevarim. Baruch haba lechol makshivim. This is Dr. Duff Forbes, Rabbi Kehilat HaMashiach B'toch Yisrael.
My dear friends, I have entitled this message number 189, Cycles That Satisfy. Among the 20 or so available definitions of a circle is one which declares that a circle is a series ending where it began. Being a series, it is prone to repeat itself. Such a circle becomes a cycle, a round of operations or events, a series that returns upon itself. In that branch of mathematics known as geometry, we are very familiar with the figure of a circle. Emerson, in his Essays on Circles, says, "The eye is the first circle, the horizon which it forms is the second, and throughout nature, this primary figure is repeated without end. It is the highest emblem in the cipher of the world." Unquote. We might add to Emerson's observations the phenomenon of a circle or cycle in animated gyration, whenever we observe the antics of the eager puppy dog bent upon the capture and exploration of its own tail. But there is another cycle, not at all amusing, to be detected in the history of Israel as divinely recorded in the Bible and found in that book known in Hebrew as Shofetim and in English as Judges, together with a relevant section of 1 Samuel. This sad cycle returns upon itself seven times in a sort of spiritual geometry, leaving behind a pattern startling in the extreme, for it reflects, among other features, the spiritual frailty of man and the superlative faithfulness of God. Our previous studies have already impressed us with the fact of the futility and fruitlessness of a life lived outside the will of God. I believe the cycles of Shofetim will certify this feature also in a most vivid manner. Now let us take another brief side glance at the character of the era, the age, the period covered by Judges, Shofetim. You will find it well, wise, and illuminating to do so, and we are not left guessing, for the book itself significantly declares no less than four times that in those days there was no king in Israel. No king in Israel? True, no human king. But Israel was not kingless. The eternal God, he had taken upon himself the might and majesty of monarchy, and God was king in Israel. Hence the tragic events recorded in Shofetim fall within the theocratic regime of Israel's history. To save you the trouble of possible inquiry, I may mention that the word theocracy, as relating to Israel, was first employed by our own Jewish historian Josephus, and it really means absolute government of the nation in all matters, whether civil or religion, by God and by God alone. Having thus discovered the character of the time, let us now discern the character of the times. Again we get our clue from the book itself. Twice we hear the declaration, "Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." What a weight of woe was hauled into history in just those four English words, "in his own eyes." If only the divine affirmation could have been, "and every man did that which was right," doubtless the annals of the entire world would have been inscribed in sequences less sorrowful. However, since every man was a law unto himself, there existed an intense condition of lawlessness. Woe to the generation that judges its judges. The Talmud rather aptly observes, taking its clue, of course, from the book of Ruth. The song of Deborah, in the 5th chapter of Judges, is clear evidence that Israel entered the promised land as a whole entity, acting unitedly and serving the eternal God as one nation. But Shofetim brings its tragic testimony that this happy condition did not persist. Tribal divisions appear and recur, and a general state of disorder and disruption, anarchy and apostasy, violences and vendetta, stain the times with dark and lurid pigments. But, and here's the point we must not miss, it is this very condition of religious corruption, moral deterioration, and national disunity that lays bare before us the disposition of man and the dispensation of God, and renders invaluable and timeless the divine revelation and illumination that shines all the more brilliantly from the annals of Shofatim because of the somber background from which they are beamed. Those times are past, but their lessons linger, and there emerges from the intricate pages of Judges for our present advantage and instruction a twofold discovery. First, the fixing of special goals specifically recounted, and secondly, the formulary of a spiritual geometry, seven times repeated. Glance at the goals. There is a trio of them. Moreover, they will be revealed as objectives sought in three differing spheres, the moral, the spiritual, and the political. In the moral realm, Israel had disobeyed God by failing to drive out fully the corrupt nations of Canaan. The Godhead now takes these very nations and weaves them into a lash with which to chastise Israel and teach him obedience. The continued presence of Canaanitish peoples in the Promised Land meant also that the deadly menace of idolatry, with all its hideous implications and practices, remained like a cancer to threaten the spiritual health of Israel. God used this very circumstance to prove and test the fidelity of his people and their attachment to the great revelation of himself that he had vouchsafed them. These, then, were the moral and spiritual goals God initiated and expressly declared in the second chapter of Judges. The author of Judges himself discloses the political objective in his third chapter. Sin spawns strife. Therefore, as a consequence of Israel's sin, he would be compelled to learn the art of war, that he might maintain his place among the nations and thus keep burning the eternal light of revealed monotheism as an advancing conqueror of the surrounding darkness of heathenism with its twin theological perils of polytheism and Unitarianism. There is current consolation in these disclosures. Somehow it seems good to know, doesn't it, that adverse experiences which may befall us and sorry circumstances which may envelop us are deprived of sheer pointlessness and utter wastage when taken up into the hands of the sovereign Lord of the universe and employed by him for purposes ultimately beneficent and thus divinely redirected towards constructive and not destructive goals. Let us cling to this comfort as we now survey the seven cycles of sorrow that certify its validity. In six of these sad cycles, it is the hand of deity that touches off each rotation through the instrumentality of foreign oppressors. Each of the six cycles is stamped with the same impressive sequence which I have summarized in the five words apostasy, anger, anguish, appeal, answer. Israel's six specifically recorded lapses into apostasy are all introduced by the fateful formula, and the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of the Eternal. This formula was varied only by the use of the adverb again in four out of the six rueful refrains. Actually, the accusations occur eight times in the book. At chapter 2, verse 11, it appears the general gravamen of the divine complaint, and at chapter 3, verse 12, we have it twice in the one verse. The consequent anger of the Eternal results in six advents of anguish for Israel. Let me tabulate the device and the duration of each divine chastisement. Firstly, 8 years' servitude to Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim. Secondly, 18 years' servitude to Eglon, king of Moab. Thirdly, 20 years oppression to Yabin, the Canaanitish king. Fourthly, 7 years depredation by the Midianites. Fifthly, 18 years oppression by the Ammonites and Philistines. And sixthly, 40 years oppression by Philistines. Thus, Israel's apostasy cost him 111 years of anguish. But there is yet another very sad cycle to be included. A cycle different in character from the 6 I have just enumerated, in that it sprang from within, and there is no record that it was initiated by the Almighty. Chronologically, it fell between the 4th and 5th cycle of foreign oppression, and its duration was only 3 years. But it was packed with grief and bloodshed. The chief actor was an upstart named Abimelech, the son of a concubine of Gideon. This usurper arrogated to himself the title of king and established his rule by violence. He himself came to a violent end, and it is recorded God thus requited the wickedness of Abimelech. Each round of wretchedness returned erring Israel to the Eternal, and wrung from the lips of the afflicted people an appeal for deliverance. The formula becomes dismally familiar. The children of Israel cried unto the Eternal. We read these words in relation to each of the foreign oppressions, except the last of the series. This apparent lack in the last of the customary prescription may yield a touching overtone to the entire series. Let me call your attention to it. Following the breaking and crushing of Israel during the 5th foreign repression, Israel had uttered his customary cry. However, we read of a merited reproach uttered by the Eternal in these terms: You cried unto me, and I saved you, yet you have forsaken me. Go and cry unto the gods, Elohim, which you have chosen. Let them save you in the time of your distress. Unquote. Nevertheless, the covenant-keeping Godhead did grant yet another answer to his people, and did deliver Israel, not only from the Ammonites, but also from the 6th subservience, that of the Philistines. But the action is recorded in another book of the Bible, that known as 1 Samuel. Of Samson, the thorn in the side of the Philistines in the book of Judges, it is significantly said, I wonder have you noticed this, that he only began to deliver Israel. These 7 sorrowful cycles are nevertheless cycles that satisfy, because they guarantee to all Israel that neither the frailty nor the frailty of the people will set aside the divine pledges of future blessing and security for the chosen people. Perhaps the very present generation has already seen the first beams of that blessed sun rising.
Yivarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, Ya'er Adonai panav eilecha v'hunecha, Yisar Adonai panav eilecha, V'yaseim lecha, Shalom. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Amen.